Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop. And today's program is a two-part series, and today's program is Understanding the Role of Immuno-Oncology in Treating Cancer. And it's really part of a series called Immuno-Oncology, a Promising New Approach to Treating Cancer. And indeed, this is a great promising new area, and you'll be hearing about this during today's program. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in this topic that we have over 490 participants on the program today. It's a wonderful group of people from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Algeria, Brazil, Canada, France, Italy, Mexico, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So this is a global call, and it's really a credit to you that you're all with us today. Today's program has been made possible by Bristol-Myers Squibb and an independent grant from Merck & Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today. I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mark Criss. Dr. Criss is attending physician, thoracic oncology service. Dr. Criss is our next speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Alan Bryce. Dr. Bryce is vice chair, division of hematology and oncology, director, genomic oncology service, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Dr. Bryce is going to address an overview of immuno-oncology, harnessing the immune system in treating cancer, and questions to ask your healthcare team about immuno-oncology. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bryce.
Thanks, Dr. Messner. Thank you, everyone, for being on the call. I think you're all on the call because you have heard or read much about how immunotherapy has truly come of age in the treatment of cancer. And so what I want to address for you today is at least give the 30,000-foot view of why we're able to use the immune system to attack cancer. You know, what are the practicalities of this, and you know, what does it mean for what we're doing in terms of cancer research and treatment moving forward? Historically, it's always been an attractive and understood concept that the immune system can play a role in fighting cancer. As you're probably aware, at a certain level, the immune system's job is to identify invaders into the body that are foreign, that shouldn't be there, and to then eradicate that by activating immune cells to attack the foreign bodies. So most typically we think of, for example, infections, whether it's pneumonia or strep throat or something like that. These are cells that are not part of your body, and the immune system is programmed to recognize them, to find the differences between the foreign cells and your own cells, and to selectively attack those cells. That key and really powerful function, though, has to be regulated, because the immune system out of control can start to attack your own cells. And when that happens, that leads to what we call autoimmune disorders. And examples of these are quite familiar to everyone. For example, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, various intestinal disorders such as Crohn's disease or others, where there's a function of the immune system attacking healthy human cells. So what that means is that the function of the immune system has to be carefully balanced between activity and overactivity. An overactive immune system can be harmful. An underactive immune system is harmful. Trying to keep the immune system in the proper balance is the real trick. And this trick lies right at the heart of the research that's led to immunotherapy in the treatment of cancers. Truly, the effort to use the immune system to attack cancer is something that has been going on for over 100 years. You know, Dr. Criss works at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, and in the earliest establishment of Memorial Sloan Kettering in its first iteration came out of early immunotherapy studies, surgeons in New York who were trying to use really some variant of immune-based approaches to attack sarcomas. And yet, despite generations of research, really many generations of brilliant researchers trying to find a way to truly harness this potential, it wasn't until this decade that we had true proven immunotherapies that extend life. The only example prior to this decade would have been perhaps stem cell transplant, where patients are getting cells from other human beings that effectively attack their cancers, and these have been used in diseases like leukemia and lymphoma. We know about things like interferon and high-dose IL-2, which were previously used, but these really had very limited benefits, only small proportions of patients. But now in 2010 and beyond, we have an explosion of available therapies, and that's what the next speakers will really address, I think, for you much more specifically. So the concept here is to find ways to convince a patient's own immune cells that the cancer is a foreign body and needs to be attacked. And the reason that's been so difficult is because as abnormal as cancer cells are, the fact of the matter is they are still 99% or more just like every other cell in the body. The differences between a cancer cell and a healthy cell at a genetic level are typically quite small. And so trying to exploit those small differences is much more challenging than, say, recognizing a pneumonia bacteria as opposed to just recognizing a cancerous cell. What we've also come to understand is that cancer is extremely intelligent in that it develops ways to avoid the immune system. So some of the therapies you're going to hear about specifically counteract the defense mechanisms that cancers have developed. And it's that balance of being able to turn on the immune system to recognize a cancer that's not all that different from a normal healthy cell, while at the same time being able to overcome the defenses of the cancer cell and also prevent overactivity of the immune system from causing damage to the rest of the patient's healthy cells, that is really at the heart of this challenge of immuno-oncology. And really that challenge is the reason why it's taken us so long to get to this point. But happily, we are now in what I truly think we can call a new era of oncology, where immunotherapy has really come to the fore, where we are seeing effective treatments, long-term outcomes in situations where we previously weren't seeing them. And frankly, there is good reason for, I think, all the excitement that you see in the media amongst patient groups and amongst physicians for the potential of immuno-oncology. So in terms of this concept of what does this mean for the patients, what should you do? I absolutely believe patients with cancer should be asking their providers, asking their physicians, if immunotherapy has a role in the treatment of their individual situations. And, presumably there's many of you on the phone right now with a wide variety of different personal scenarios. So I can't really break it down individually, but it is, I think, appropriate and important that you ask your physician, does immunotherapy play a role in my disease, whether that be approved therapies, therapies for the future, therapies for now, or clinical trials? And I think the next physicians up will address some of these things more specifically. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bryce. That was an outstanding, really, overview for us to begin this program today, so thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Mark Chris. Dr. Chris is attending physician, Thoracic Oncology Service, the William and Joy Rain Chair in Thoracic Oncology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He's also professor of medicine while at Cornell Medical College. Dr. Chris is going to address the emerging role of immuno-oncology, how immuno-oncology offers new cancer treatment options, and clinical trial updates. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Chris.
Oh, thank you, Carolyn. You know, just echoing the words of Dr. Bryce, it has been a very long journey where immune therapies have gone from the idea that they could benefit patients to the point where we can now prove that they do. I think it's an interesting coincidence that in many ways the father of immunotherapy is also the father of chemotherapy, and that is Paul Ehrlich. What we have seen, and I think we're going to continue to see over the next many years, is a convergence of all the different kinds of therapies we have to fight cancers. I think Dr. Bryce already reminded us how smart cancer cells are and how they continue to learn and to try to find ways to outwit our therapies. And I think what we're going to see more and more is, in addition to therapies targeting specific components of the immune system, coupling those with various traditional cytotoxic chemotherapies, which clearly can modulate the immune system in a way that the other treatments can be made more effective. The use of radiation and surgery in releasing antigens that would stimulate the immune system. And lastly, the convergence of our understanding of molecular mechanisms of cancer growth and cancer maintenance that impact the body's response to the immune system. And I'll do my best to highlight some of these in the next few minutes. We have a real expert here in the care of patients with melanoma, Dr. Daniels, so I'll kind of gloss over the data in melanoma. But that is where many of these drugs first have been tested, first have proven their benefit, and probably where, as a whole, there's the most mature information about how these drugs can affect patients. I think Dr. Bryce already talked to you about the main idea here is to take the body's own defenses, to use them to fight the cancer, and also to counteract the clever ways that cancer has used to shut down our immune system in such that the cancer is not destroyed. There are probably two classes of medicines that are available right now. Actually, one class, if you want to call them T-cell checkpoint inhibitors. And the two groups of drugs under that category are drugs that target PD-1 or PD-L1. And the second one, those that target anti-CTLA-4. I know this sounds like total mumbo-jumbo, but this is the kind of thing that you need to talk to your doctor about, which ones of these treatments could be best suited for you. And it takes some knowledge and discussion, both on the by your doctor and also to try to have that clearly explained to you so you can understand. There are approved drugs already targeting PD-1 and PD-L1, the drug called nivolumab and a second called pembrolizumab. These are available now. They have approvals for both melanoma and lung. And there are others in clinical trial and pretty far along. One is called atezolizumab. It's got another name, MPDL-3280A. And the fourth one is called MEDI-4736. All of these are drugs targeting PD-1 and PD-L1. The two drugs targeting CTLA-4 would be a drug called ipilimumab and a second one called tremelimumab. Again, the first one approved, the second one in clinical trials. In lung cancers, in just the last few weeks, we've had the approval of nivolumab for the treatment of patients with squamous lung cancers. And a few weeks ago at the meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, data was released that shows that the same drug, the nivolumab, is effective against adenocarcinomas, the most common type of lung cancer. And just yesterday, posted on the NCCN guidelines were the approval, as it were, for the use of these agents in patients with adenocarcinoma, and that approval and posting on the NCCN guidelines will signal their coverage by Medicare and third-party payers. So today, patients with virtually all kinds of lung cancers can have nivolumab available to them. The current testing has been largely in patients that already had an initial therapy, had growth of their cancer despite an initial therapy, and I think that is where these drugs will first be used, but clearly there's a lot of information that they can be helpful elsewhere. What we've seen in the testing of these drugs when they've been compared to standard chemotherapies in the setting of treatment after the initial treatment stops helping is that they can shrink the cancer more effectively, that they can lengthen life, and actually that their side effects by and large are less than they're seen with chemotherapy. Also at the ASCO meeting this year, there was a major presentation about the use of these two classes of T-cell checkpoint inhibitors together in melanoma, combining ipilimumab with nivolumab, and in those situations, it was shown that that combination appeared to be more effective than nivolumab alone, appeared to be more effective than ipilimumab alone, and also that nivolumab appeared to be more effective than ipilimumab alone. And again, these are patients with malignant melanoma. So it's sadly very complicated, but blessedly very hopeful. It's going to involve your doctor and you to learn a new vocabulary to find out which of these drugs would be likely available to you, which would be likely to be effective for you, and then to discuss their use in your particular case. They have a different spectrum of side effects, not the usual things you associate with chemotherapy, lowering the blood counts, you know, a loss of hair, nerve damage. These drugs can cause I'll call it hyperactivity of the immune system, leading to things like irritation of the colon, irritation of the lung, irritation of the kidneys, irritation of the liver, hepatitis. These are the kind of side effects that your doctors have learned how to manage, and they'll need to discuss them with you. The last thing I want to talk about is the emerging convergence of this the use of these therapies with our understanding of the genomic status of tumors. What we are able to do now is to test patients' tumor tissues. And one of the things that we found in melanoma, in a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine by Dr. Snyder, in a paper also in the New England Journal of Medicine just published within the last week, in colorectal cancer, and in a paper published in the journal Science in non-small cell lung cancer, adenocarcinoma, where you have a high number of mutations in tumor tissues, you see a much better responsiveness and duration of benefit from these immune checkpoint inhibitors. So I think more and more doctors will be able to link testing on the genomic landscape of a tumor with the likelihood of benefit to immune therapies. This is a rapidly expanding field. As I mentioned, most of these scientific reports just appeared in the last few weeks. It is a way, though, that we're going to be able to decide who is most likely to benefit from these different therapies, and also to help your doctors decide which of them to give you. So, for example, in lung cancer, if you have a low mutational burden, I think the preponderance of information today would say that a chemotherapy would be a better choice for you. Conversely, if you have a high mutational burden, a drug like nivolumab or ipilimumab might be a more appropriate one for you as well. The other nice thing about this is that it seems to work in many different kinds of cancers. I think many people in the lung cancer area felt that if a mutation wasn't present, that there really were fewer options for them. As it turns out, in this case, it's the people with the more mutations, and those generally are not the ones with the drivers like EGFR or ALK. Those are the ones more likely to benefit from the immune checkpoint inhibitors. So it means new options, new opportunities for all kinds of cancers, and also as our testing ability improves. So I think the bottom line here is new drugs are here. More new drugs are in the pipeline to be tested. They're particularly affecting melanoma and lung cancers. Others are being tested now. And I encourage you, I think just as Dr. Bryce said, to talk to your doctor about what options are available to you in this space.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Chris. That was really outstanding. Thank you, as always. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Gregory Daniels. Dr. Daniels is Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine, University of California, San Diego, Rebecca and John Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Daniels is going to address how research contributes to treatment options, examples of immunotherapy in primary prevention of cancer, treatment of cancer, and preventing recurrence of cancer, and also cancer vaccines. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Daniels.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you everybody for being on the call and taking the time out to listen to this. Because as the previous speakers, Dr. Bryce and Chris, mentioned, things are happening really quickly, and it's a challenge to keep up even for all of us. And I like my topics because I get to give some specific examples in areas where I have some passion, and that is prevention of cancer, as well as some treatment options. And I picked a few examples to just highlight where the field is, where we think the challenges are, and where hopefully we'll go with all this stuff. So prevention, when I think about cancer prevention and immune therapy, most people, as mentioned by Dr. Bryce and Dr. Chris, are vaccines. And vaccines at least have the intellectual attraction that, okay, we don't have a problem now. Let's alert ourselves to the dangers that may come, and let's use vaccines to do that in a low harmful way, but a big benefit by keeping stuff away. And so that's how vaccines approach cancer. Well, we've known that cancer has been caused by genetic changes over the years. However, what's come to light through some of our treatment discoveries has been that cancer also really is the result of chronic inflammation. And chronic inflammation, whether it's tobacco smoke or viral infections that are irritating the liver or other things in our environment, cause a growth-promoting or a tumor-promoting environment that cancer cells, as they're developing, take advantage of and both exploit and become addicted to. And so when oncologists are thinking about cancer these days, we're not just thinking about the mutations, but the new hallmarks of cancer include the inflammatory environment that the cancer developed from and is growing in. Some of this, like I mentioned, were tobacco. We don't really have a good vaccine against tobacco. Please stop smoking, and if there's anybody still in the world that still does. But we do have vaccines against viral infections, and so these have been a good opportunity for us to step in and consider this type of approach with an immune therapy. I'll focus on HPV or human papillomavirus. There are tens of different types of human papillomaviruses out there, but there are a smaller subset that seem to cause cancers in humans. And these high-risk types cause cervical cancers, throat cancers, warts, and other things. Now that we have identified how these viruses are causing the cancers and which ones cause them, we have the opportunity to vaccinate against these type of HPV viruses. And there's two vaccines on the market that are recommended for children under the age at the age of 11 and upwards. So the vaccines have been shown to be fairly safe, but also very effective at getting rid of these precancerous changes that we see caused by the viruses that lead to the development of cancer through this inflammatory process. So vaccines in viral cancer preventions are a great example of how we can use the immune system up front to help prevent cancer. Treatments is exploding, and there are many treatments, as Dr. Chris just alluded to, that we're seeing activities in colorectal cancer, in lung cancer, which was always felt to be really not immunogenic type of cancer. But again, getting back to this idea that inflammation has always been present there, always been driving the growth of cancer. And when patients come into the clinic, oftentimes things are changing a little bit, but still oftentimes they say, gee, doc, I just want to boost my immune system. I want to supercharge it and get rid of this cancer. And what I'd spend some time is just redefining what that really means. Boosting and supercharging are marketing terms. Those aren't really describing the biology of what's going on. In fact, your immune system is usually in a very healthy state for most patients, and it's doing just the right thing. It's helping, unfortunately, helping the cancer grow. It's healing this unhealing wound. And so when we think about targeting treatments, we have to change that relationship and not just boost the relationship, but actually switch it from a cancer-promoting to a cancer-fighting relationship. Melanoma has been a great example of success in immune therapies. Interleukin-2 was approved back in the 1990s by work out of the National Cancer Institute, and for select patients gave durable, treatment-free survival that's been measured in decades for patients with metastatic melanoma. Problem was that it wasn't for everybody, and it worked in a small number of patients. But it gave us the hope that drove the development of many other medications, and beginning in 2011, we got, as mentioned, ipilimumab or Yervoy, pembrolizumab or Keytruda, and now the list is just growing to multiple tongue-twisting immune-modulating medications. And so we're seeing improved responses. And a new set of adverse events. Now, when you talk to your physician, it's important to realize that not all immune therapies are the same, that they target different pathways in your cancer growth process. And so their side effects are different. And each one carries a list of challenges that just need to be monitored and reacted to in a proactive kind of way. Lastly, recurrence or prevention of cancer in patients who have already had cancer. Again, people have tried vaccines in this strategy. However, it hasn't been as successful as in the initial primary prevention. And that's because vaccines are part of that boosting or supercharging the immune system, and that's not really what we need to do. And so the classic vaccines have not done very well in this space, although there's still ongoing clinical trials trying to fix that. But what has achieved some response has been, again, this modulation of the immune response. Interferon in melanoma has always had a role in delaying the recurrence, although it's a very tough treatment. And its benefit in overall survival is modest. So that spurred work looking at these new immune modulators like ipilimumab or nivolumab, and clinical trials are ongoing and look very promising for these agents in the prevention of recurrence in very high-risk patients. So I'm going to steal from Dr. Bryce. He talked about the convergence of therapies and chemotherapies, maybe closer to immune therapies than we thought, and the integration of multiple things. But I'm going to talk about the convergence of how we even just think about cancer and a change in life and a new way of living that addresses this idea of immune therapy and this chronic inflammation and changing that. Because if you really take a broad view of it, immune therapy includes things like exercise and diet and how those things influence how we and our body sees and adapts to the world. So I'd say a take-home message is, you know, we're getting better understanding in tumor development all the time. Science is really supercharging us in getting us to that point where we can rationally address cancer, but also the idea that with this understanding will come better prevention strategies that we can integrate into our life before we even meet cancer. So thank you very much for listening.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Daniels. That was excellent and just a wonderful presentation about all the how to integrate this into treatment course for patients and everyone. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Sarah Kelly. Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker. She is the older adult program coordinator here at Cancer Care. Ms. Kelly is going to address Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services, the role of support groups, and resources to get more information about immuno-oncology. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I'd actually like to thank everyone on this call. It's wonderful to hear about these exciting advances in care. I imagine there's going to be a lot of questions at the latter part of the program. So as Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. I work with many people who are diagnosed with cancer and their loved ones. Today we've been talking about managing your care and quality of life in terms of immunotherapy and advances in care. I'd like to really begin by speaking about the importance also of creating a support network as part of that care and how cancer care can be a part of that network. So a little about us, we're a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone who is affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York area and then over the phone nationally. We have support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in New York. We do those over the phone nationally and also online nationally and internationally. We provide education programs like the one we're on today. We can provide practical help, assistance navigating the healthcare system. We also have some limited financial assistance as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and as I mentioned earlier, completely free of charge. And an oncology social worker really is trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and their family, friends, their loved ones, really the support network. We're trained to help patients and their supports tackle problems that accompany the disease, such as financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and really psychological impact and care. And I find that adjusting to and finding ways of coping with this diagnosis and all the areas I mentioned is an important part of the healing process, and I actually consider it to be an important part of treatment. I consider it to be treatment. As you know, cancer affects not just the patient, it affects the whole support network, all of the loved ones. And it's so important for each person who is affected by this to know that you are not alone in this. And that is really a take-home message that I'd like for you all to have, is that you don't have to do this alone. You don't have to walk the path alone. Asking for help, joining a support group, contacting a social worker for counseling is really a sign of strength. With support groups, you can connect with others who are going through a similar situation. Individual counseling gives you a space that's just yours to voice these concerns and navigate any of the issues I mentioned earlier. And I find the connections help lessen the isolation that often comes when you're diagnosed with cancer or when a loved one is diagnosed. And feeling well emotionally, I find, also helps you better deal with the diagnosis and also the treatment. At this time, we are currently providing several different online support groups, telephone support groups, face-to-face support groups, as well as the individual counseling, both on the phone and face-to-face in the New York area. If you are interested in learning more about this, I highly recommend visiting our website. We have a very comprehensive website, and that's www.cancercare.org. You can also call us on our HOPE line, and that number is 1-800-813-4673, or 1-800-813-HOPE is an easy way of remembering it. We've learned a lot from today's program. There's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Please know we're here to help you understand what it means for you and your family. If you have questions about today's call, if it's raised concerns for you, you just want more information, please contact us. You know, we can help you go through and make sense of some of this. I'm also briefly just going to talk about some resources for immuno-oncology. And I'm going to start, actually, this is something that Dr. Chris had really stressed, but talking to your doctor, talking with your medical team about this to find out what's available for you, what treatments would be best suited for you in terms of what's happening with your care. You really want to have those conversations, and that's where you're going to get some really great information that's also tailored to you in your specific case. We all know that everyone is very individual, and each case is individual, so you want to talk to your medical team with that. If you're looking for other information, I can recommend the American Cancer Society, who has a fact sheet and a booklet, I believe, on immunotherapy and some of the new resources that are coming out, and you can find them online, and that's cancer.org. You can actually get it right from the website. If you'd like them to mail you a hard copy, you can reach them at 1-800-227-2345. And then, of course, I recommend the National Cancer Institute also has this information, and you can reach them online. It's www.cancer.gov. And then you can also reach them by phone, and that's 1-800-4-CANCER or 1-800-422-6237. So those are just some resources for you if you'd like to learn more. Again, even using those resources, please take this back to the medical team and have those important conversations with your doctor. And then finally, I just want to remind you, again, we're here for you. You really are not alone going through this. Our services are here to help you as things are coming up for you, whether it's questions or you just need support. Please, please contact us. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Kelly. That was really excellent. Thank you, and lots of good resources as well. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions, and I know there are a lot of questions coming in, so actually I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and Stephanie, if you would explain to people how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question, I'm going to explain to at the very end how we actually build them, how you can get your questions answered. So. But let's see what we can take right now, Stephanie.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Our first question comes from Sue O. Your line is open.
Hi. I would just like to ask Dr. Alan Bryce a question.
Yes. Your question, please.
I have CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and you were talking about that you can use the immune system to attack cancer, but what if your disease is in the immune system? How, that's where the CLL is. It's in the bone marrow, and it is in the immune system, so how do you attack that?
Okay, well, thank you for that excellent question, and I'm going to ask Dr. Bryce to address that question in a general way, and of course we encourage you to go back to your treating healthcare team. But Dr. Bryce, can you give just some general guidelines around this question and also as it applies to other cancers as well?
Yeah, so it's a very kind of appropriate question in the sense that the hematologic cancers, CLL being one of them, lymphomas, leukemias, myeloma, those diseases are disorders of the immune cells in the first place. So it's a legitimate question to wonder, is immunotherapy still possibly applicable in diseases of the bone marrow, of the immune cells? And in fact, the answer is yes. So there are ongoing studies with immunotherapy in hematologic malignancies. As I referred to before, allogeneic stem cell transplant is in essence an immunotherapy because much of the benefit of that is allowing the transplanted immune system to attack the residual cancer. There is data in Hodgkin's disease looking at immunotherapy that seems quite promising. So the answer is yes. Even though we're talking about immune system disorders of leukemia or lymphoma or whatnot, there is absolutely still potential for immunotherapy in this space, and it's it is appropriate to ask this question to your physician to say, how does this play a role in my specific situation?
Well, thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Gina J. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. It's pretty much just a general question. Wondering if there are any, you know, current or on the horizon immunotherapies for ERPR positive breast cancer survivor to prevent recurrence. I know that there aren't, you know, vaccines that are, you know, successful, but any immunotherapies current or on the horizon moving forward to, and also for premenopausal women.
Well, thank you for that question. Dr. Chris, can you address it in a general way in terms of the breast cancer population?
Yeah, there have been clinical trials of agents targeting the immune system in breast cancer. And today, there isn't a treatment that's been identified that can be specifically used for breast cancers. I would, again, urge you to sit down with your healthcare team, see what trials would be available for you in your area, in your institution, and there may be something that your doctor can recommend for you. So I'd ask you to pursue that on a person-by-person basis. But there's not an approved treatment right now for breast cancer, be it a vaccine or a one of these T-cell checkpoint inhibitors.
Excellent. And we have some questions from our online participants as well. So a question for Dr. Daniels. Could you say more about how diet and exercise can be used to control inflammation? For example, Dr. Daniels, can you discuss that just in a general way?
Sure. So it's such a passionate topic when patients come in. I think probably 80% of my patients ask about diet and exercise, and I wish I had the definitive to give them, but I try to give them just general advice. There are examples in oncology, for example, in colorectal cancer, where patients who participate in an exercise program have much better outcomes, and this has been seen in lung cancer and across the board. We also know that we can measure immune changes for healthy volunteers who go through exercise programs, and we can see changes that reflect what we consider a more healthy anti-cancer kind of change. And we see the reverse, that certain diets, high carbohydrates, potentially causing less good changes in your immune system. Hard thing to study, so it's a hard thing to give firm recommendations. But what I just tell patients is, a healthy lifestyle is really a one where we are vigorous in our activities and modest in our intake. But we're still figuring those things out.
Thank you. Excellent. And another question we have for Dr. Chris. Please describe the difference between immune checkpoint inhibitors and monoclonal antibody, monoclonal human antibody.
That's a great question, and just adding to the confusion, the agents we use to affect the immune checkpoints in a way that to help our body fight the cancer are themselves monoclonal antibodies. So going back to biology, whenever our integrity, our bodies are attacked, our immune system rises to that attack. And one of the ways it does that is it generates proteins that are specific to the attacker, very, very specific. So if you have the measles, your body generates a very specific protein that attacks the measles antigen. And that is one of the ways that your body gets the immune system revved up to eliminate that attacker. What science has been able to learn is that when you find one of those antigens, again, I mentioned before the case of a measles antigen, well, you can find certain other protein antigens or enantiomer antigens on the cancer. You can, in a laboratory, create these proteins that could then be injected into you that could attack those antigenic targets. And those are so-called monoclonal antibodies. Perhaps the two best examples of those in cancer are the use of rituximab. Rituximab is targets a certain antigen on certain immune cells and helps the body fight lymphoma. It's probably as close as we have to a standard therapy for people with lymphoma. Another example of a monoclonal antibody is Herceptin, trastuzumab, drugs that target the HER2 protein, commonly found on breast cancers, gastric cancers, and other cancers as well. These same monoclonal antibodies are used to target ways that the cancer cells have found out to turn off the effects of our immune system against them and against cancer. So the way that an immune checkpoint inhibitor works is that you inject a monoclonal antibody against a specific antigen, and then the most common one is an antigen called PD-L1 found on cancer cells. And what it does is it blocks the effects of that PD-L1, which in essence turn off your body's immune system to fight the cancer. So immune monoclonal antibodies are used as treatments directly by targeting antigens, but also by targeting those proteins that can turn off the immune system. So they can work in a couple of ways. That's complicated. It's complicated for us doctor types, and it's extremely complicated for you. Again, I urge you to ask the question again, to go to the websites that are out there that can help. And I specifically refer folks to cancer.net. It's a very good website that tries to explain in words that we all can understand various aspects of cancer and cancer treatment, and to try to straighten this out. But it is sort of complicated, but it's with the right amount of question asking and time, it's I think understandable to everybody.
Excellent, and these are questions worth asking over and over again for Dr. Chris's remarks. It's very important because they are complicated to understand, but you will be able to understand them. You've been able to understand so many things over the years for many of you on the call today. And our next question, Stephanie.
Our next question comes from Terry H. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I have finished up a chemo treatment, and I am now on a Avastin maintenance. And I was just wondering if you had any information on how well that works for the maintenance of ovarian cancer.
Well, thank you for that question, and I'm going to ask Dr. Rice if you could just address this in a general way, and then we definitely encourage you to speak with your healthcare provider, your physician as well. But Dr. Rice, can you give some just general guidelines, because I think people probably are wondering for each of their cancers how things apply, so if there are some general guidelines you could provide.
Yeah, that's right. So when we talk about the development of new therapies, whether it's immunotherapy or anything else, the efficacy of any approach is different from cancer to cancer. And really, we have to be very specific within any type of cancer. There's sub-varieties. You can't talk about breast cancer as one disease, melanoma as one disease, prostate. There's different groups within every grouping. And then we talk about where a drug is best positioned. Is it with other therapies in combination? Is it as an add-on after the completion of one set of therapies? So you go from chemo and then you move on to maintenance with another drug. And should it be after surgery? Should it be before surgery? Should it be only in advanced disease or early? All of these questions are the kind of the bread and butter questions that we in the research community have to answer, because the goal is to get optimal outcomes with minimal toxicities. We want to maintain quality of life and extend life. Now, we can't generalize the answer. And this is the problem. This is why we have to look at every individual situation. There is not a one-size-fits-all answer. So even though we talk about immuno-oncology as kind of one topic, and even though we talk about cancer as one topic, really there's some hundreds of different varieties on this theme when we get down to the specific, or perhaps thousands, depending upon how specific you want to be. So ultimately, can immunotherapy be a good maintenance therapy? The answer is certainly we think it can. Can it be applied early or late in the disease course? We think yes, potentially. But again, it really comes down to the specifics, and we really can't generalize. What we can say is for most cancers and most scenarios, we're still in the early days of this immuno-oncology revolution. And so most scenarios are still likely going to be clinical trials rather than standard of care, with the biggest exception being melanoma. But even there, we're extremely aggressive in ongoing clinical trials. Lung cancer as well, despite what Dr. Chris was saying with the new approvals, there's going to be ongoing studies to further refine the use. So in general, the answer is still please talk to your individual situation about your specific situation. And in all likelihood, you know, trials are more likely to be the answer than actual FDA-approved therapies.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you so much. And we have a question for one of our online participants, for Dr. Daniels. And the question was, what do you mean when you say that the immune system actually helps cancer grow and should not just be boosted? How does that work? So, Dr. Daniels, could you just address this again in a general way, helping everyone to understand this concept?
Sure. So the immune system is there. Well, I'll take a step back. And there are many components to an immune response, and there's what we call an innate response, where these are cells, your white blood cells, part of your white blood cells, just recognize wounds and rush in there. And so anybody knows that when they get a scrape, that there's blood that stops flowing and a scab that forms and redness that happens, and that's inflammation that's rushing in there to try to heal that wound. Your innate immune system's part of that, as well as if there's any tetanus in the environment, your adaptive immune system, which has been vaccinated against the tetanus, has rushed in there and prevented you from getting an infection with tetanus. So that's an immune response to a wound. The cancer has also learned that that healing process where your body's bringing in these white blood cells and blood vessels to help your normal skin heal is a good process to take advantage of. Cancers also need blood vessels. And when we look inside a cancer, the tumor cells themselves, the real cancer cells themselves, oftentimes make up a minority of that lump or bump or that spot on the scan. What's inhabited that tumor are blood vessels and supporting cells. Well, that's your immune system. And so what we're trying to do with our immune therapies is to get it away from going in and giving it blood vessels, and Avastin, the previous caller had asked about Avastin, is a way to stop those blood vessels from forming, or changing the way our T cells look at it, and instead of saying that it's, oh, a good wound that we need to heal, instead saying this is a bad wound we need to get rid of. And so that's what I mean by it's not just boosting the immune system, but changing a relationship, changing the complex network that's already in there.
Thank you. Excellent. And another online question. What are the prospects for immunotherapy treatments for renal cancer or metastatic renal cancer? And again, Dr. Chris, if you could just address this in a general way, and I just want to let the audience know that we do have a program on Thursday on new perspectives in the treatment of renal cell cancer. So it's tomorrow, actually. So there'll be much more discussed then. But if you wanted to say something about that, or just and also all many cancers, because I think that everyone is trying to apply it to their own particular situation here.
Yeah, no, I think the more we learn, the more we know how different cancers are from person to person, and sometimes even within the same person, they're different. So I think one critical piece of information that came out in the discussions today is to know that information about your cancer is specific to the type of cancer and to you and to the special characteristics of the cancer that your doctors discover by an immune or a genetic evaluation. As it's turned out, the use of immune treatments in renal cell cancer is one of the first cancers actually to be targeted. We mentioned earlier about the use of interleukin, and interleukin was used in renal cancer as well from its earliest testing. So there are immune treatments that are available. So far, there are none approved beyond interleukin 2. But again, for specifically not just kidney cancer in general, but your specific kind of kidney cancer, make sure that you talk to your doctors about that. Kidney cancer as well has been the one that have had very dramatic changes based on the specific drugs that block certain enzymes in kidney cancer cells, and there's a whole host of drugs available now to fight kidney cancer. And I urge you to take advantage of every option that you have if you have that illness to make sure you get the best outcome.
And I'm going to, as we conclude, ask each speaker if you would give the audience a takeaway, what you'd like to give them as a takeaway from today's program, because there are a lot of wonderful points made, a lot of great questions. So I'm going to ask if Dr. Bryce, would you just, is there something you want people to definitely take away from this program today?
And I think the most important point is the fact that the field of oncology is changing at a tremendous pace right now. It's a bit shocking to think about how many new therapies and indications are coming out with every major international meeting. And it's frankly a very exciting time for patients and for us physicians alike. So that being the case, I think patients really want to be tuned into the concept of getting the best cutting-edge therapy by considering clinical studies. Most of these therapies are available only on study for years before they're ever FDA approved. And at this point, I think we all have experience with there's no question with patients who went on clinical trials for immunotherapy who really probably wouldn't be alive today had they not done that, and now they're doing quite well. So really, please, think about clinical trials as much as possible and talk to your providers about that. This is still the early days of this this revolution, and we still need patients who will advocate for themselves and kind of have the willingness to go on these early clinical studies.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Chris?
Yeah, I think just to echo that again, all the good news we're delivering today happened because individual patients decided to be part of clinical trials. And even though treatment may be out there, we can always do better. We want to give you the opportunity to do better, and a clinical trial is a way to do that. And the other word today is hope. And what we have today that we didn't have a year ago is many, many options. More options to offer individuals that just didn't exist months or sometimes even weeks ago. Many of those options come through clinical trials, and please be open to that. And I would take hope, take that you're going to have more things available to you to fight your cancer, and that you can live the kind of life you want to live, and live it longer and live it better.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Daniels. Oh, Dr. Daniels?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was on mute. I was going to say that all three of us are at academic centers, and, of course, I, too, also promote clinical trials. I was a little late to the call coming in because the two patients I saw this morning both were looking for clinical trials. One I had actually seen a year before, went off to an institution that had a better trial for her. She did great on it. She's coming back just for follow-up, and a second patient referred in to consider another clinical trial. And because of this is where all the exciting stuff is happening, I think. But I'll go back to, again, stealing Dr. Bryce's convergence. And the take-home I want people to just think about is, well, yeah, these are all great therapies, but they're giving us insight further into the way cancers develop and this relationship with our immune system. And we're trying to change it with pharmacologic agents and trying to prevent cancer, trying to treat cancer. But it would be wonderful as we expand this knowledge to figure out other ways in terms of our lifestyle, other ways to even avoid this whole topic of cancer. And I think the information that we're ultimately going to get out of this is some hope for lowering the cancer burden in our country and getting some better strategies for prevention.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Ms. Kelly.
Just so briefly, I'll just go back to the take-home message that I shared earlier, which is that as you're going through this, as you're going through your own individual cancer journey, whether you're a patient or whether you're a loved one, that you are not alone in this, and that we are absolutely here to help you with whatever questions you may have, issues coming up. We're also here for you as a support.
Thank you. And I want to thank all of our speakers. You have just been an outstanding group of speakers. I want to thank all of you in the audience today. You've been amazing. Your questions have been phenomenal and really have helped to enhance the call today. So I just want to, in concluding the call today, I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that in planning a program like this, we do recognize that you all have many needs and many questions that go far beyond 1 hour. So I want to give you a couple of take-home things as well. If you have medical questions that you really want to have more help with that you didn't get a chance to ask either today or in the future, I would suggest that you would call the National Cancer Institute toll-free line, which is 1-800-422-6237. Again, 1-800-422-6237. And if you have questions just about the emotional, financial, practical, social aspects of dealing with cancer, what we call the psychosocial areas of dealing with cancer, your concerns, you'd like someone to talk to, interested in a support group, either a telephone support group or an online group, or interested in exploring getting some financial assistance or practical help, please do call our oncology social workers here at Cancer Care at our helpline at 1-800-813-HOPE. Again, 1-800-813-4673. The most important thing, and Ms. Kelly also had said this quite eloquently, is that we don't want anyone to think, as the call ends today, that you're left alone now to deal with everything. We want you to know that you're now part of the cancer care community, our family here, and that you can call us. We are simply a phone call away, or you can visit our website. I want to thank you all for your participation today. I want to remind you that there is a part two to this program on Tuesday, June 23rd, on managing the side effects of immunotherapy. And so that may be a program that I know some of you have signed up for already, but in case not, just to remind you of that. Again, I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you for your participation.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.